bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Yo, what's up, friends?
And Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, everybody, that's me.
So here's what I want to do for this episode. And I want to, people can consider sort of a standalone kind of thing. If you're getting to After Things, or this, you're going to tell people like you should listen to After Things. It could be this episode or it could not be. And what it's going to be is we're going to go around each of us and talk about, because if you want, I'm not going to force anybody to. I'm going to say, hey, I've been involved in, you know, writing books now professionally, not quite 10 years, but several years now. And I would say if I were going to give advice to somebody starting now in this day and age, what I would tell them to do. And then I can say, Justin, if you want to do podcasting, Brian, if you want to do YouTube, you know, Bryce, if you want to talk a bit about, you know, working within, you know, the sphere of modern post-production, et cetera, too, that would be, I think, could be helpful because everything's changed. Everything's changed since we started and things have evolved since we got there, you know, where we are now. And when I got into it, it's different now. So I'll just start off by saying, like, if you want to be a writer today, my suggestion is this. The biggest change I think that has happened is the publishers do not have the power they had before. In the heads of many writers, they do. People think they go, oh, I want to write a book. And they think they're ergo, they have to be published. And I'm like, no, write a book, have it professionally edited, have it put out looking professional. But you do not need that in the ecosystem of Amazon, of Apple Books, Google Play, etc. The publisher used to solve the problem of getting your book distributed to the places where people would buy it. They would print tons of your copies of your book. They would ship it to bookstores so people could go buy it. Now, more and more people read books on ebook form or listen to them in audio form. And that job of the publisher has changed. That's not what, you know, you don't need a publisher to do that now. And the publisher was the big gatekeeper because they could only put out so many books. But you as an independent can do whatever you want. So I would say my advice, if you want to write now, is pick a genre, pick maybe even get a little bit more specific in a genre. If you say, I like Western, but maybe I'm going to focus on like, you know, things that take place during a specific time period, or I like paranormal stories, but I'm going to kind of do a story. I'm going to do my own Frankenstein romance series or something. Pick a genre. And I would encourage you to think about, continue to do within that genre to build up an audience. Books don't have to be as long as they were before. Take a look there, but self-publishing is the way I would go about it now. I would use software like Scrivener is great for writing. I would say that as far as building up an audience is, I think the thing that worked years ago works well today too, is if you have somebody who has a good voice, you could release forms of it in podcast form. There's programs like Kindle Unlimited, which allow you to let people who have a subscription to read your book for free, which is a great way to build an audience. I guess what I'm saying is like now it's so much easier to build an audience than it was before, but you have to give up your expectations that people had 10 years ago. Give up the idea of I have to have a publisher and let go of the idea that, oh, I have to have somebody pay for every single copy of the book. You know, like I said, Kindle Unlimited is a program where you can publish your book and then people can read it as many copies or read as much as they want digitally. And then you get paid per page out of a fund. So that's another big thing that's developed since then. So that's so, my short answer.
Question. What is true today about the journey that you just described that was not true 15 years ago? What is a viable path now that was not a viable path before?
Well, I think it comes down to the idea of the indie writer. The indie writer can make as much or more. I think that the same amount of energy that goes into traditional publishing put into self-publishing, I think you will make more as a self-published author.
I also think, and this is, I watched it happen, the fastest way to become a published author is to be a successful indie author. Like that is, you know, nothing matters in this world in terms of getting hired for anything than proving you can do it. Proving, and especially in a boom bust field like publishing, which has always been a boom bust field and used to be very shamanistic in its, the people, the wise people from behind the pearly gates. Now it's easier for them to make their decisions because they can see sales metrics. They can see rankings. They can see reviews. So the idea that you are the hidden gem for which will it be, you know, rise to the top of a pile of manuscripts and then you will be shepherded to fame is a far less likely path than you building up even a modest sized audience with good reviews. So you are demonstrated to be somebody that is self-motivated, can produce something that would be well read. I mean, I guess also that's the other thing. I don't know if when I was first working with Andrew, how many of those stories would have even been read by a publisher, you know, because there was a very little track record of what Andrew had written. But I sure as hell know publishers started reading them because they had to. It became something they needed to do because it was gaining a certain amount of success. So you forced them to read your stuff. I think it would have happened way faster than just sending it in and waiting.
Well, in the I'd say the big paradigm that's changed considerably is from like 15 years ago was that, let's say I had a book and my friend said, this is a good book 15 years ago. And I wanted to do something with it. At that point, your options were really try to get a publisher to publish it, and the odds were going to be against you. Publishers turn down really good books every year. It's not like they find, oh, we found one good book to publish. For every book they publish, there's dozens and dozens or more of books that they would have liked to have, but they couldn't. So that was the hard part about publishing, is just limited capacity. So if you had that book 15 years ago, there's not much you could do. You could do that. You could do a self-publishing route then, like physically print copies, spend thousands of dollars to do that, and try to sell them out of the trunk of your car, which is just does not work. It's not really, I mean, there will be exceptions to that rule, but we'll just assume that it really does not work and it's not a thing I'd advise to somebody. Now, and even when I started in 2011, my way of trying to get the books out there was Justin and I would do serialize them in podcasts. We would offer them for like 99 cents or so, you know, to try to do the really, really cheap pricing on it. And that was the way, or we'd do free. Those models got pushed away. Like you can't really price it 99 cents easily anymore, and you can't really do free. But what we have now, and this is the program I was talking about, is the Kindle Unlimited program, where any author can take their book, say, I want to make it available to Kindle Unlimited, and there are millions of people that subscribe to this all-you-can-read ebook service from Amazon. And in there, the discovery process can work wonderfully well because you will get people who will read everything in a genre. They won't pay the $4 to buy a book, but if it's available for as part of their subscription plan, they will do that. And if the second and third book in there cost money, then often you get people who will jump off and go buy your book. But also it's just this wonderful platform, in my opinion, for just, you know, finding readers. I wanted, when we started, I gave away my books for free because I wanted to build an audience. I wasn't trying to cash out on it. And Brian's talked about this. Justin's talked about this, is like, build your audience, build your value, then figure out how to harvest. And for me, it was like, yeah, let me build this audience to do that. And now the biggest change I'd say right now is that you can take that book, push it into the Kindle Unlimited platform, and you will see all of a sudden you're getting readers, you're getting reviews, and even, you know, for, you know, minimal promotion, because just there's going to be somebody in that category that's going to want to read it. They wouldn't buy it, but they'll read it in that platform.
Do you think the entire idea of somebody who has a story, who has, you know, written the ultimate all-American novel or whatever, and is just looking for the right gatekeeper to bring it to the masses, is that dead? Because I get the impression that publishers in general just want to know, what's your platform? How many people can you reach? Is whatever it is you have good enough that we won't be embarrassed by it? And then that's all they want to hear.
Yeah. I think that they're still looking for publishers and they still perform a vital service. And I work with publishers and I've had great experiences, but you know, I have a clear understanding of what they can and cannot do and what their role is, that they still look for kind of the diamonds in the rough or to discover authors that maybe don't have platforms. But most publishers now, most of the times, they take a look at, they want to find authors with existing fan bases. They want to find authors that say like, oh yeah, I've got 90,000 fans on Twitter. I've been self-publishing my books and doing this. They want that. And my point I point to authors is like, why do you need the publisher then? You know, if the publisher is a great, I work with a great publisher that offers things that I can't do and can expand way beyond. I've had other publishers that have come to me and before that I'm like, no, like this offer for what you're doing, like I will in one email campaign, I will do more than I could sell more of my own book than you can do. And there's nothing you're offering to do to me that I can't do for myself. And that's the case of some publishers. And sometimes if an author, maybe it works out great if you picked, but it is a different model. I mean, it's the model. Yeah. Publishers, everybody I talked to, and I was like, yeah, they want to know what my Twitter following is. They want to know this. Like, yeah, they want to figure out the safest sort of bet, but it also tells you that's how little power they have, that they can't take an author who's unknown and push them over, you know, reliably. So, you know, I'd say that's a big change in the landscape, and it is frustrating because it will make it harder to find, you know, the more obscure and the really talented people, because, you know, there are amazing writers out there that just aren't on Twitter, aren't active, don't have any sort of fan base, and publishers will be like, nah, we're not going to do this. And those could be some of the biggest hits, you know, some of the next big books. So it's a loss.
So in the spirit of the same question, there is a bit of a sort of an epiphany that we had internally. The Modern Rogue channel recently crossed over 1 million subscribers. And looking at the numbers, I'm fairly certain that not only are they celebrating creators when they hit, you know, 100,000 subscribers or 1 million subscribers or whatever, but I'm almost certain that there's a full-on like promotion that happens in that moment where the algorithm, no, it's not an individual human being, but I believe that what they're saying is like, well, hello, kid, you've been here for 1, 2, 3 years. You seem to show up every single week. You deliver on time. You deliver content that 80% of the people tend to stick through 80% of. Congratulations, we're going to give you a raise. And of course, we're not going to give you a raise in money, but we will give you a raise in terms of you are now a proven, reliable entity. And so we'll give you a raise in attention on that.
There was a thing recently, just to pin this on, because this is rather recent news. People have data mined a little bit of YouTube and found that they do have a rather proprietary number that they use to grade channels based on advertiser friendliness. And so I would not be surprised if being over these different milestones affects that number as well, because that number possibly has something to do with how the algorithm weighs the channel when it's recommending and searching stuff.
Yeah, I guess the big epiphany for me is that there's a temptation when you first start getting into YouTube to believe that if you're good enough, you could be an overnight success. And I think it's important for everybody to realize that time matters as a vector. Like somebody who's very, very good is not as valuable as somebody who's very, very good consistently over 3 years. Somebody who is very, very good consistently over 3 years is a more valuable commodity than just somebody who is equally as good. And it took me a while to figure that out when it came to launching a brand new channel with the Modern Rogue.
That makes sense. And that, because like you would seem that the fear of that algorithm is that you push somebody in at the expense of somebody else, and then all of a sudden they just sort of peter out, and you directed all those eyeballs over there versus a channel that could become much more advertiser friendly.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like every episode that you put out reflects on us, the brand or the network, you know, that is supporting you.
So I'm like, Brian, like I want to do kind of a cool retro behind the scenes of movies, YouTube series. Like I want to kind of go back and dig into, I'm just making this up, whatever kind of thing. And I want to do this. I've been taking classes on video production, been working on my speech, and I've been doing this now. You know, I've been making, I'm 10 episodes in. What advice would you give me?
Oh boy. I mean, in general, same advice that we've always given, which is, you know, be bad so that you can become good. Give yourself a safe place to be bad. The biggest thing is just go. It's better to do than not do. And there's a million very, very good reasons why you should wait and make sure you do it right, and you should ignore all of them.
So one of the things that I guess is that, like, going cross-platform and working with other creators is even more valuable now, though. Like, you know, the more you can be seen in other places would seem like that might be a valuable thing to do now for a person. It's like, don't just be in your own silo, is doing multiple shows and multiple channel or multiple shows a better idea now than it was 10 years ago?
100%. I mean, that's quite literally why we're building out the Modern Rogue World headquarters, is for the opportunity to make collaborations easier, more affordable, and simpler. But
do you think that scales down, though, for a single person to be handling multiple channels and multiple shows rather than focusing in on one and making that their big? I mean, yeah, we run 8 Patreons here, but that's because we have enough people to man all of that stuff.
Right. And
we have
right. Enough so talent. As a matter of fact, it I believe it does, or I suspect it does. But from the flip side, which is, let's say you don't have an infrastructure. What you do is you have your own channel. What you need to do is figure out, what's your message? What do you have to say to the world? And then just look at every other channel out there and say, who could benefit? Who could I give essentially free advice to? And, you know, Justin and I went through this with the Twit Network, where it's like, we were willing to put forth a lot of time, energy, and effort to put out unique hot takes in the world of tech that they did not have to pay us for. But we did it because we had the brief opportunity to hop onto their stage and audition to their audience and hopefully seduce some of them into our comedy program.
I think that, you know, it was interesting. There was an article that came out, or a study that came out, and it was said that, like, number one job that American kids want to be is like a YouTube personality. And they're like, the number one job that Chinese kids want is to be an astronaut. On one hand, it was sort of like, hey, look at these dumb American kids want to be YouTubers. But I'm like, I don't know. Like, you don't get killed in the United States for being a politically unpopular YouTuber versus China. Sounds like astronauts, the safer job in China. But also, and part of it too, is like, we do put so much emphasis on these personalities, people like that, where, you know, Chinese media is going to celebrate people who work for the government and do things that reinforce sort of the state ideals. So I didn't know how much to read into that, but I certainly know that when I, you know, you talk to young people, like, you know, way more of them want to go into the entertainment fields than when I was a kid, and way more of them look at this as an out because it's what they watch all day.
Because also it's like, to say a YouTube star is, I even think, kind of a definition that we don't really even fully have a handle on. Like, are you guys aware that one of the biggest boxing pay-per-views of the year was two YouTubers were fighting in the Staples Center, and it sold a ton of tickets in the Staples Center in LA, got a gigantic deal with the same platform that has some of the other top boxers in the world signed to contracts. Like, so when you really think of, like, okay, well, what is YouTube? What is new media? What is social media? It really is like in a world where so many of, you know, the old platforms are not dead, but they are certainly humbled. You can put together things that are heretofore unthinkable. The fact that was two YouTubers fighting, KSI versus Logan Paul, who, by the way, is 2 years away from being, like, banned from Japan for filming a corpse and thought to be kind of, like, canceled, and that was that. Now, a massive sports celebrity that has garnered, like, fairly positive press, even. So there is just right now a fascinating world of, like, no matter what, whatever you thought about new media, and I think I've had years worth of collective conversation with everybody that's on this podcast about what social media is, what new media is, and we have been kind of consistently wrong with how, like, you know, initially we thought, oh, it'll just be television. It's not. It's something very different, and we're continuing to see exactly what that means.
So What's your advice, Justin? You could either address anything you want, journalism, podcasting.
No, I'll do podcasting. Number one, expect to make less money than in either YouTube or publishing, because there are fewer direct channels. I mean, obviously, Patreon is, you know, before Patreon, it was very, very hard to make money in podcasting. Now, thankfully, that is there. And those tools will continue to grow. The biggest thing is that unlike YouTube, which at the very least requires you to be multidisciplinary in terms of video and audio, and publishing, which is a fairly solitary pursuit and is far more about, you know, you getting the product that you need and figuring out a place to then put that finished product where it is, podcasting is, by its nature, at least, a very personal and a very, you know, the audience is very expectant. And also it leads the easiest and the quickest to people doing, you know, not great versions of it. Not to say that there's not a tremendous host of not great books or YouTube, but I think that it's easier to make a very bad podcast. The point I guess I'm trying to get at is, man, the if I were to try to make a boot camp for podcasters, the first thing that I would want somebody to do is literally take all the ideas they have for a podcast and all the friends they want to do a podcast with and all that, and literally just do one episode of each of them. Instead of starting 15 podcasts, do 15 episodes. Literally just understand what that is and how easy it is to get people to work with you. And how do you like it? Do you like the end result? What would you do going forward? Because the biggest way that I think people get frustrated with podcasting is you start it and you start to learn a lot of those really important lessons that Brian talks about all the time about finding a good place to be bad. But then, because of the nature of the beast, you realize maybe a few. And again, there are lessons that you can learn right off the bat, and then there's lessons that you have to be at a certain level to really appreciate. You realize, oh no, wait, this is why I don't have eight people on a show. This is why I want to make sure that things are edited in a certain way. This is a value. This is good. This is bad. Like, that would be the number one thing that I would say now is, like, just do a bunch. Just go and make them quick, make them short. The faster that you can learn the idea that brevity is the soul of wit, oh my God. Like, beat yourself up until you realize, keep this stuff as tight as you possibly can. Nobody ever listened to a 20-minute podcast and said, oh my God, that was a great 20 minutes. I wish that it were 40 and have that be a bad thing. That's always a good thing. That means that people are going to want to listen to your next episode.
I think you said something really interesting a little earlier, that podcast audience are kind of more expectant than some of the other audiences, right? Because they buy in, right? Subscribing to the feed is a certain commitment that can be taken away at any time. And because the landscape of podcasting is still rather light on discoverability, if you lose someone, you might lose them forever. And they will forget about you, and they won't check you out again until you are in their face and give them a reason to. And so,
yeah,
like, definitely get started very quickly. You know, make sure you find out what it is you want to do and get, you know, and stick to that core. But also getting into a headspace of this audience can be very like deep rooted, but they also, like, you're asking a lot of time out of them, and so stuff like fidelity does become a sticking point. Like, they're also as fickle. They can be very committed. They can also be very fickle, and there's so many podcasts about so many topics that that time that it takes you to get good is very important, because there are other people out there that they will go to if they want that thing.
The other thing is, and this is something that I think does, this is kind of a second or third level thing, but it is a good North Star to understand, because for me, man, it really was, even in the last year, it clarified a lot of philosophical stuff in my head in terms of podcasting. Get in touch with your listener, you the listener, right? Because you the listener, impatient, selfish, angry listener, is a great clarifying, blinding truth to the stuff that you are doing. And the less you rely on, oh, but I'm having fun, I'm doing a really great job, I really like this joke, I really like, you know, the fact that we went another 30 minutes, or like, really, it's about the digressions. It's like, okay, if that is the case, then wonder about yourself, the listener. Try to separate you, the creator, and you, the listener, because there's a lot where, you know, I just kind of revamp both of the major podcasts that I do, and the politics one in specific, because I just kind of realized that we're about to get an organic wave of new people just checking out politics podcasts. And I had to face some hard truths about the stuff that I was doing before and how that came off, and the audience that I want to attract, and how I can make a good first impression, because I certainly have a hardcore audience that, you know, is going to follow even if I change a few things. But it was clarifying to me, and I've been doing this stuff for over 10 years, right? Like and there's, it's difficult, but also, you know, it all of these things are bound by the idea that they are processes, and all that you can ever do is learn a lesson from when you do things wrong, and remember and file away how and why something right worked, and seek to understand that.
That's such a critical point, because I think that things you get better at faster are things where you get feedback faster. And, you know, it's hard to become a better writer when you write a book every couple years and then you don't know, was it, and you're waiting for if the rejection was because of publishers or it sucked or whatever. You know, I wrote 10 books in my first year, because I realized with books, you put stuff out there, people tell you what they like, what they don't like. You can measure things, you can do that. We all got into podcasting around the same time, but I know my time spent in podcasting is nowhere near the value you guys have spent podcasting, because you guys produce so much more and have had so many reps. And that's one of the things that made me think about it. Like, sure, I got into the same time Justin and Brian, but when I do a show with you guys and I see your guys' sense of timing and all these other things that comes from the reps, it makes me appreciate, like, yeah, you don't just go, well, I've been doing this for 10 years. It's like, you know, you meet trainers in the gym, like, I've been training for 10 years. It's like, I don't know if you're a good trainer, you know, like, you've been maybe, but how do I know? Did it take you 6 weeks to look like that or 6 years? And so time spent's not the same as effort.
Yeah, it's a matter of iterations across the board.
Bryce, any thoughts?
From a production side, I think a lot of the general stuff that we always talk about, which is like, get started, find a way to get started, find a way to make something as soon as you can so that you can keep getting better and better. Make sure that you have a feedback, you know, element to it, so that you are listening to what you're putting out and trying to put yourself in your viewer or listener or reader's eyes. But also on the actual production side, like, make sure you're forward thinking about the skills that you're growing, right? If you are, let's say if you're doing videos, right? I'm sure you can probably get a lot of good, you can get some good work out of a GoPro for a while, but remember to think about, like, what else can you do to step up? What is the next real step to going to a real camera, going to real audio? When it comes to podcasting, are you just using a Yeti Blue USB microphone? Is that all you can afford? Do you know how it works inside and out? And then what's the next step for you, right? Are you going to have a million USB microphones in your computer? Or are you going to move on to a real mixer? Are you going to move on to to real editing software or more proper professional software, because not only are you creating a thing which you can maybe monetize and maybe build an audience for, you're also building your skills, and you have to make sure that you are constantly thinking about how you can build up your skills in a way that will benefit you in the long run. When I started doing music, I mean, back in high school, I was using... music's different because it's kind of like writing, where as long as you get to the end product, there's not too many too many specific ways you have to work. But I know one of the first things that I bought was a real copy of Ableton, which is the software that I use, because I liked using it. I had been pirating for a while, and I knew that I liked it. And it's a real sort of professional grade software. And I still use that software to this day. I haven't upgraded, but I still use that one. Same with video editing, right? Are you using Windows Movie Maker? How long are you going to keep using Windows Movie Maker? When can you move up to Premiere or Avid or Final Cut even, right? Like, continue to find the next ways that you can build out your skills professionally, because there are just going to be some things you can't do in Movie Maker, right? You're just not going to have the same ability to do graphics or little things that you want, that you're going to want to do to make your product better. You're not going to be able to, because you'll be limited by your tools, which you will feel because you're limited by your skills. So continue to expand yourself, because you're going to want to do more things. You're going to want to do bigger things, and you need to know that when you make the step to doing that, that you also have the tools and the skills to do that.
That is so huge. So huge. Because I know for me, this project that I've been working on, literally, I initially wanted to bring in a professional to organize and edit everything. And then at a certain point, I realized I don't even know what I'm asking for. Like, I'm going to get sucked into this thing where somebody else is, because if you're actually dealing with a true professional, and I was, you know, they're looking to me. I'm the quarterback. I'm the one deciding where everything should go. They're the hands that are going to assemble it in the best way. And there is no way that I could really even know exactly what that was until I did it myself. Let your frustration be your guide in everything, right? Like, let your frustration be, that is a guiding, your hate for, like, oh God, I sound like crap. Ah, this book cover looks like garbage. Oh, this edit, I mean, like, I just don't know why I can't look, you know, like these other people look. Like, it's just so frustrating. Yeah. That is, congratulations. That is the cheat code to life. It is hidden in your hatred of your own product, is like, just go drive toward that.
I don't want to tell everyone that the secret is self-loathing, but I know that watching the early days of Scam School, it was very clear, like, what needed to be fixed. It's like, would you shut up? Would you get to the point? Would you skip this? What are you doing? Stop impressing yourself, and so on.
And if you're finding that you are having a difficult time being critical of yourself, or have a, like, I don't love listening to my own voice, and that's just, it makes it tough for me on some of that stuff. Go and ask for help. Ask for that feedback, and ask for, you know, say, like, be real with me. Tell me when you are frustrated by this thing. You're not going to hurt my feelings, but let me know the things that I'm doing that are annoying you, because that's what you need. You need that feedback. And yes, if you can't be it for yourself, then you can definitely, someone else will be it for you.
Yeah. That self-loathing thing, like, man, like, cause like in my head, I always have, you know, nobody cares. And like, and I remember when I would perform, you know, as a stage performer, in the back of my mind was always like, they're bored, you know? And so, like, I never tried to be as entertained, you know, by myself as I hope people were being entertained. I always assumed that it wasn't. And if I think it's finding that right balance to be healthy, I've twice in the last couple of weeks, my girlfriend's got a film that's out at film festival, and you'll see periodically, and I've had this twice where we've seen somebody who has been like, they make a film and maybe the film's good or maybe it's not so or whatever. And then often, you know, somebody like, how long have you been working on it? And the answer will be like, oh, 5 years or whatever. And you're like, and they're like, well, I didn't know what I was doing. And I'm like, I've twice, I've wanted to just raise my hand. I'm like, hey, maybe a year in, take a goddamn lynda.com course. You know, like, mm-hmm. at what point do you say, maybe I should learn some more about this thing that I'm spending, you know, my time, my money, and all this into? And that's, I would say that's it. I don't know why it frustrates me, but I guess it is that a number of times where you talk to people like, yeah, I want to do this. I want to do a podcasting thing. Well, you know, lynda.com, you can take a course or somewhere for free that will teach you the basic. I'm like, nah, I'm just going to go record it and do it. You know, like, oh, I'm going to go make a movie. Like, okay, I'm a big believer, like, throwing your hat over the fence and doing something. But once you decide you want to do it, that weird, like, the artist sort of, yeah, I don't want to learn the business side. I want somebody else to do this and that. That I don't want to invest anything in myself and improvement attitude drives me nuts.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. I do think that is a second level lesson where some people just need to burn their hand on that stove, right? And so that's why when I was saying, like, just do a bunch of one-off podcasts, because that, you trust me, you're going to find out why an 8-person podcast is a bad idea. You're going to find out why you need to get a better mic or figure out a way that you can maximize the sound off your mic. You're going to figure out that, you know, it takes time. And look, I hated listening to myself. I have to on every, especially with the politics stuff. I have to now. I'm just doing too much on the editing side. I'm not recording as live anymore. And so sometimes I leave things on the timeline that I wasn't supposed to, or the timing's off. And when you think about that, again, the frustration, I'm like, ah, that's a missed moment. Like, if I was able to hit that in rhythm or hit that in beat, then people would feel like, oh, that's like the mark of professionalism. So it's like, I get it. If you just are like, you know, you're just that kid on Christmas, your dream's right there, you unwrap it and you don't want to read the instructions, you just want to go play with it, then go ahead and watch it break in your hands, but do it as fast as possible. The one professional thing I would say is make it a 5-month thing where you put out something that you're like, oh, this is bad, instead of a 5-year.
I'm all for it. Just do it. Don't hold back and say, well, I got to take this course or do that. I'm like, do it. But then once you realize, like, I've met people like in the TV industry, like, you know, who at the start, like, oh, I'm going to go do this thing. Oh, you should take a course on this thing. Like, nah, I don't have time to go do this. And then 3 months later, they're showing me a thing. I'm like, yeah, I've had this problem. I've been trying to solve it for weeks. And, you know, spent all night doing this. And it's like, yeah, and then 2 hours into the course you were going to take that I suggested, they would have solved this thing for you. But the stubbornness to say, I don't have time to do this, which manifests itself. And like, I watch it, people 5 years later, you watch, like, this thing should not have taken that much time. Because at some point you got to go, oh yeah, I guess I got to learn this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because so. Every late night you spend Googling how to solve a problem, there was probably 50% of the time, at least, there was an answer in some sort of course, right?
Yeah. And
that's a learning process, but still.
And I'm super, super guilty of this too, because I have bad habits in coding and stuff like that, that if I spent more time to learn more advanced techniques. So let me just say that it's like, mm-hmm. I have my own version of where I don't follow my own advice, and it's starting to bite me in the ass.
Yeah. So I think that's the broad advice I would give to someone is, you know, figure out how you can be better at what you want to do here, because there will be more projects beyond this one and you will want to get better. Right, you need to build good habits and good skills.
Well, all right, let's do picks.
Watchmen, it's good. Anyone who says it's not good is a liar.
And fired.
No,
I didn't say it was bad. I just said I will get back to it.
you did tell it to pound sand,
and it should go pound sand until it's done.
To do things to your
well. Yeah, Watchmen.
Hey, I started watching Glow season 3. I really have liked it. I'm like 8 episodes in, but Ashley and I have really liked it. It's it continues to be a compelling show. And also, you know, since I moved out west, I've spent I guess between magic and moving out here, I've just spent a lot more time in Vegas. But it is a very fun snapshot of what 80s Vegas, was, as they take this cult television show and turn it into a regular show at a casino. But there's some fun stuff in there, and I hope it resolves well.
But you're in season three, did you just said?
Season three, yeah.
So not season four, which is the newest one, right?
No, season three is the new one.
Yeah. Season three is the newest one.
In Las Vegas?
And you liked this?
I like season, yeah, so far, yeah.
I know you didn't love it, Andrew, right? Because
I didn't finish it. I'm like, wow, I'm like two episodes in, nothing's happened, I'm done. I'm going to go watch something where things happen.
Mm-hmm. So not Watchmen.
I mean,
yeah, I mean, I guess I could see where there are frustrations that I have with the show in terms of kind of where they want to pin some of the emotional arcs. But there's enough of that world that I like being in that I kept watching. And also it's like, it's 30 minutes. So it's a little less than 30 when you watch it. It's fairly painless for a Friday night.
Yeah. No, I'm sure. I just, for me, it's like, it was one of the things like all right, we're going to stop the show here to go have this long conversation. It's going to be overly long to get to a point you're already ahead of. And then, all right, now we're going to, I'm glad you like it.
it's an after things pick. It was a nice Friday night with the missus.
Yeah. Any other picks?
I got a little pick. This is out now on the Apple Arcade. It's a game called Guildlings. It looks like it might end up being on PC or some other platforms. This is a neat little sort of adventure game where you are given a cell phone, but cell phones are like wizard books, and so you end up being trapped. I'm only just scratched the surface on it, but this is a very neat little game where you're kind of doing a little bit of puzzle solving, of trying to traverse these areas with your friends as you have inadvertently become a guild master, some sort of wizard person. And there's a little bit of a fighting turn-based mechanic where your partner's emotions control some of the skills and spells that they can do. The writing is really fun and cute. It's very sort of like very modern text sort of talk. And it looks really great. It's got this really interesting sort of cell shaded look. And it so far has been a really easy play. So if you've got the Apple Arcade, I think Guildlings, a new title.
So if you've already taken the leap into doing the Apple Arcade ecosystem, what I have a hard time with is figuring out like what's the best filtering mechanism to figure out like what I should get into.
I mean, just scroll through the page on the App Store. You know, they do have them all listed, but you can they've got little carousels for like, oh, family stuff, oh, action stuff, oh, puzzly sort of stuff. I'd say take a look at that, and then they give you a push notification every week or every other week whenever they add new games, so you can, because they're not too many games at this point. And so when they add a few, but I don't have anything that I check. On Twitter, I saw someone, a games journalist, mention Guildlings and it's free. So I just did it. I end up downloading a bunch of them and a lot of them never even starting, never even like opening up the first time, but, yeah.
My pick is going to be a frequent pick here, and my biggest frustration with it is the rather unwieldy title that I can never remember, and I always have to go look it up on Amazon.
The Bible.
Yes. Which version? And that's Scott Adams' book, How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big, kind of the story of my life. And the biggest takeaway from that book is what we talk about a lot, is skill stacking and just building your skill stack, picking up skills. It doesn't mean you have to go to college. It doesn't mean you have to do anything, but when you can draw a circle and say, I know this thing that has value, and the more things you know that have value, the greater your skill stack is. You know, looking at, you know, Justin, Brian, and Bryce, these are all people that have different skills that might seem separate in isolation, but when you package them together, Justin's journalism background, you know, Justin's having learned podcasting, Justin's sense of humor and having done sketch comedy and stuff and that, you know, Brian's live performing stuff, but then Brian adapting to doing, you know, your first, your YouTube shows and podcast, all of these things come together, and that's how you create a talented person, not just one talent, but multiple. You know, you can have a musician that's has a wonderful voice, but if they have no stage presence, you know, and they have maybe, you know, a poor exercise routine, then maybe they're not going to be a person that's going to tour. Or we can come up with many examples, but athletes, you know, you break down what makes a great professional athlete isn't just one thing. It is a number of physical skills and mental skills, et cetera. And the same applies to us. So,
yeah. One of my favorite takeaways from that book was he talks about how it's better to be, instead of being the best plumber, it's better to be a good plumber who can also speak Spanish. Because you'll make much more money that way.
Yep, 100%. So, gentlemen, it's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.